Fred Alan Wolf is a physicist, writer, lecturer who earned his Ph.D. in theoretical physics at UCLA in 1963. Now, he continues to write, lecture throughout the world, and conduct research on the relationship of quantum physics to consciousness. Dr. Wolf has taught at the University of London, the University of Paris, the Hahn-Mittner Institute for Nuclear Physics in Berlin, the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and San Diego State University right here in the United States. His work in quantum physics and consciousness is well known through his popular and scientific writings. Dr. Wolf's fascination with the world of physics began one afternoon as a child at a local matinee when the newsreel revealed the awesome power and might of the world's first atomic explosion. This fascination continued, leading Wolf to study mathematics, physics, and in 1963, receiving his Ph.D. in theoretical physics from UCLA. He began researching the field of high atmospheric particle behavior following a nuclear explosion. Wolf's inquiring mind has delved into the relationship between human consciousness, psychology, physiology, and mystical and spiritual. His investigations have taken him from the intimate discussions with physicist David Bohm to the magical and mysterious jungles of Peru, from the master classes with Nobel laureate Richard Feynman to the high deserts of Mexico, from a significant meeting with Werner Heisenberg to the hot coals of a firewalk. He's been all over. Wolf is well known for his simplification of the new physics and is perhaps best known as the author of Taking the Quantum Leap, which in 1982 was the recipient of the prestigious National Book Award for Science. My pleasure to welcome back to Coast, Dr. Fred Alan Wolf. Hello, Fred. How are you?
I'm very fine, George. It's a pleasure to be back on Coast to Coast again.
Always, always. I don't know if the little mind effort that we tried to prevent some serious problems in the Middle East has worked, but you know what? I can say right now we know for sure that it's not been knocked out of the water yet, has it?
Well, I believe that we are stimulating a lot of positive, proactive thinking, which may help alleviate the situation from boiling over. So let's just keep going to it. Keep thinking positively about peace and loving those people that that you're connected to by this one mind that we're all part of. And I think it is having an effect. We're seeing many groups now coming out and talking about peaceful ways, and I think that is going to be helpful.
Fred, the one thing that might be working as well is yesterday they scared the living dickens out of us by talking about the possibility of dirty bombs and everything else, which I guess always remains possible. But now they're saying that the chief informant who gave them the information fails a lie detector test, might have been making the whole story up, and now I'm beginning to wonder if we might have had some kind of bearing on that.
It's very possible. When it comes to the mind and the way mind is perceived, the way a mind perceives the world, we can very well change a lot of things. So don't give up. Those of you that are thinking along these lines, just be strong and keep the peaceful fire burning. It will work. We will achieve peace. This is not going to end.
Well, and to those of us, I mean, you know, me being an old Navy veteran, you know, I want to punish our enemies as much as we have to. But in this particular case, I'd like to get it done with minimal casualties. And the best way, I think, for that to happen, Fred, is what you and I have been talking about now over the last couple weeks. And that's with this massive mind consciousness, which I'm beginning to understand more and more. You got to tell me, though, that as a kid, you're in this movie theater and you're watching the newsreel and boom, up comes this atomic explosion film. What's going through your young mind at that time, huh?
Well, there was a lot going through my young mind at that time because I was also moving from the stage of prepubescence into puberty.
So yeah, you had
a
more
lot of explosions
your,
going on there.
Yeah, you had more in your mind than the atomic bomb, I guess, huh?
Yes, I think so. But definitely the bomb awakened something in me. I felt strangely, well, not mystified in the sense of like being dumbfounded, but mystified in the sense of an awakened feeling of awe and presence, that the world was more than... I mean, it's like waking up from a dream. I mean, you're in a very foggy state, and suddenly you're awakened, and you see things maybe in a way that you hadn't seen before. And I think that awakening has been a propellant for me and moved me into the study, the serious study of modern science, particularly theoretical physics and quantum mechanics.
Were you in awe when you saw the newsreel, or were you frightened, or both?
I wasn't frightened. I wasn't frightened at all. I was really in awe, and I can't remember now the time sequence, but I do remember that I used to dream. I used to have this dream, this recurring dream of an atom bomb going off and being present and watching it go off. Now I don't know if that was because I'd seen the newsreel or had read about it or something. I don't know, but it did stay with me. And of course, I was a kid during the time. I've always been a kid in war. I mean, I was born in the mid-30s, the beginning of 1935, the end of 1934. So Germany was coming to power during that time, and then World War II started.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised with rationing and that sort of thing. So, you know, in a way, the war energy was always around me, so to speak. And then we had these periods of time of some peace between 45 and 55, but then the Cold War began to occur. And before long, there was, you know, Korea and then Vietnam. So there's always been this, you know, feeling hanging over, and it even affected my going to school. In order to stay in college, I enlisted in the ROTC at the University of Illinois and became a second lieutenant in the United States Air Force in order to, I planned to, you know, serve, but I didn't want to serve as a private. I thought I'd rather go in as an officer. The military mind and the idea of war and all of the basic ideas dealing with war were always part of my growing up in my early years.
Well, of course, you know those second lieutenants are always the one that they send up to the front lines.
That's what I heard.
Yeah. Go for it, Lieutenant Fred. You know what? The newsreel that you saw, though, as a kid must have been what I have seen in pictures and movies of atomic explosions, where I remember the one scene where they have some houses, and they might have been cardboard. I don't know. And you've got that big whoosh effect, and they're just gone. They're obliterated. They're no more. And I remember seeing that, and I said, oh, my God. Is that the same one you saw?
I don't know if that's what I saw. I think what I saw was the first blast. I think that we saw didn't show any ground destruction. What it showed was just the mushroom, the first mushroom cloud. I think that was the very first one that we saw. And I'm not sure if that was the very first one that was exploded that we actually saw on newsreels. They may have captured that, but they may not have shown that in the actual newsreel. It was also in color. And color when I was, you know, a young kid, color was, most films are black and white.
Oh, yeah, that was a novelty then, sure.
Right, so color to me was, whoa, and you could see some of the color as I remember it. And I don't know how to describe it. It was so awesome. I heard about bombs, and I, you know, played war games as a kid and had a bombardier outfit that I used to ride in my pretend plane and bomb the little villages down below. They used to have these bombardier outfits for kids. They don't have them anymore. Now they get people on computers.
Hey, you're a physicist. I've got to ask you this question. Yeah. With this breaking science story about them saying the universe will expand forever.
Sure.
I can't, Fred, with my feeble little brain, understand or comprehend how can something expand into nothingness. I can't figure it out. Can you get me there?
Well, I'll do my best. It is incomprehensible, particularly when you try to picture it. But one way to try to picture it would be to imagine a balloon. But you have to imagine that you live on the surface of the balloon. You don't really. You live in a three-dimensional space. But you have to imagine that you live on the surface of a balloon. And then when you go moving about as freely as possible, the only way that you can move is on that surface. You can't go into the surface like inside the balloon.
Right.
You can't jump off the surface to go flying in the air. All you know, all the space that you know that you exist in, is that surface of the balloon. Now, that's hard to imagine.
Which you could travel all around, theoretically.
That's right.
Right.
You would travel all around. And, for example, they used to say, well, the universe is curved. That means if you go in a straight line and continue going and going and going and going and going, eventually you're going to come right back to where you started from.
Yes.
And you think, well, how can that be possible? If I keep going in a straight line, I'm just going to go on to infinity. But now imagine that you're on that balloon. And now as you start going in a straight line, which means staying on the balloon, you're going to walk on a great circle all the way around, like any of the great circles that travels around that balloon, right?
Okay.
And you come back to where you started from. So when they say the universe is curved, they're thinking of it in the analogous way as we think of a balloon is a curved surface. So when they think of an expanding universe, they think of it in the analogous way of the balloon expanding.
Ah.
You see? So now you're on a surface of, you're on the balloon, you're sitting on that balloon, and the universe is expanding. So that means when you look out at distant stars, which are also on the surface of the balloon, they're moving further and further away from you.
So it doesn't matter what the balloon is expanding into, it's expanding
right.
within itself.
What physicists would say is that it's expanding in a dimension or a space that we can't experience. It's unimaginable dimension of space, in the same sense that you're on the surface of a balloon and you can't imagine going into or jumping out. I mean, you could talk about it, but you don't know what that would be like to actually experienced.
You may have saved me from insanity, Fred.
Yeah, that's the only way I can think about it. And by the way, that's a very common. If you go into the grandiose textbooks of general relativity, as written by people like John Archibald Wheeler and Kip Thorne at Caltech and things like that's a standard model picture they use, and I'm sure they still teach it at Caltech.
What are the possibilities of many balloons?
That's also in the offing right now, parallel universes. And now they're working with the notion of membranes, universes that are connected together by a very thin skin called, they use the term B-R-A-N-E, not B-R-A-I-N, as brain. And they mean somehow that these universes like touch, and they still can expand. And they're touching in another dimension, the dimension of the expansion, for example. So you can imagine a bunch of balloons blowing up, and you're on one of them, and there's another one over there, and, hi, neighbor, how you doing? As his universe expands.
Will we ever be able to travel from balloon to balloon or universe to universe?
Well, I think so. This is very difficult because people don't see exactly how that could be done, and they don't quite see how these universes are connected. But maybe as we develop a better understanding of how quantum physics and which is the physics of the small, so to speak, and relativity physics, which is kind of the physics of the big and the fast, if we can see how to join those two together in a more successful way, we may see that these different balloons are really parallel universes. They were really just like reflections, like in a giant kaleidoscopic mirror world.
Fred, have you been able in your life to bridge the gap between hard science and religion? Have you been able to somehow cross each other?
You know, I have to tell you honestly, I've always had difficulty with religion. I have no problem following the disciplines of science. I loved the disciplinary aspect of science, but I found it very somehow unsettling or unnerving to follow the disciplines of religion. I'm being very honest. I consider myself spiritual, but I don't consider myself to be a religious person.
Okay.
So,
the word religion, I think, connotates all kinds of definitions, which we won't have to get into right now.
It does, and I have experienced spiritual teachings in Catholic Church, in a Jewish synagogue, with an imam in a Muslim temple, in Hindu teachings, in Tibet, not in Tibet, but in Dharamsala with the Dalai Lama in India, Buddhist teaching. So I've been in various spiritual backgrounds, And I feel some connection to them all, but I also don't feel connected to any of them in a real religious sense. And maybe that's my shortcoming and my failure to not make a connection, say, I am this or I am that. But I kind of feel that it's more important for me to maintain a kind of closeness to spirituality for all, with respect for all of the spiritual teachings, but maintain a distance from any of them.
Well, do you believe this, that and regardless of how it happened, we'll get into that, do you believe that whatever this universal design is, that it could be directly related to either a higher consciousness or some kind of order or methodology there, that this did not happen by accident?
This is the most fundamental and interesting question having to deal with, in the simplistic notion, science versus creationism versus science. But that really, you know, obliterates or muddies the water. The question is whether the order we see in the universe has come from some higher power, like God or some manifestation of great spirit, as the Native Americans might speak mm-hmm. about it. And it's simplistic and easy to say it does, and I believe it does. I definitely am convinced it does. But it's in order to get into it, to really have a sense of what that means, you have to begin to look at it more scientifically. And I think that's where some people, you know, get a little afraid. They think, well, you can't do that. Well, I think you can do it. I think there is an order to the universe. I think there is something going on that's beyond our immediate
comprehension,
and we do get inklings of it from time to time. But more important than the intellectual inklings we get are the opportunities for experiencing this mystery and awe of the universe. And I'm fortunate enough to have a number of those experiences, and I feel very blessed that they've been given to me.
Do you believe that when Fred Allen Wolf passes on, and God forbid, let's hope it's a long, long time from now, but that either your consciousness or your soul, whatever you want to call it, moves on to another level, another plane?
What I believe happens is that the recognition that I am the one mind becomes much stronger. From what I understand and what my experience has taught me dealing with death of loved ones around me is it takes a certain period of time before that adjustment takes place. You kind of carry with you the baggage of your own body, so to speak. You have your body image, and you've had so much years of investiture in how to operate that body that even when you pass on, you still think you're in it. But after a certain period of time, that begins to dissolve away, and you begin to recognize that you're really connected. You've always been connected, and you begin to recognize, in a certain sense, who you truly are. And that true recognition is one of great relief and love, seeing the light, falling in. I kind of welcome this. I'm not, you know, I'm like everybody else. When I think about it, I think, oh my God, I'm going to die. But, you know, like everybody else wakes up in the middle of the night sometimes and think, hey, wait a minute. I may not survive. But then you begin to breathe in deeply, and then suddenly you start thinking, you know, I'm going back. I'm going back home. I'm returning to the source I've always been a part of. And if you can do that in waking life, better for you.
I'll tell you what, we're going to take a quick break, and I have literally just lost about 20 minutes of time somewhere because it has just buzzed by. This has got to be the fastest half hour I've ever experienced in my life. We'll be back. My guest is Dr. Fred Allen Wolf. We're going to talk about parallel universes, the spiritual universe, mind into matter. You got it. We're going to talk about it. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. George Norrie, Dr. Fred Alan Wolf, my guest. Fred, in a strange sense, are atoms with the electrons, the protons, neutrons, are they alive? I mean, because they have movement to them. They seem to have order. They seem to have some kind of intelligence. So would you say that they could be alive in a strange sense?
I would say they're alive. I would say that everything is alive. I would define, you know, that matter itself is part of the living process. But to the extent that they're conscious and how conscious they are, depends on how they might be collected together. In other words, the kind of consciousness that we experience is sort of unity of consciousness of all of the atoms and molecules that comprise our brains doing the dance that they do is really rather remarkable, considering that each of them may not be experiencing anything like a thought. They may be experiencing something like a kind of primal consciousness, but we experience things like thoughts and feelings and intuitions as an integrating factor. And how we do that it has to do, I believe, with listening to this tune of this one wave, that what I call the one mind, which really moves and generates all of the things that we normally call human consciousness. What I think is happening is that matter dances to that wave. And when it dances by bouncing off and reflecting from it in a certain way, it produces the kinds of conscious experiences at the various levels that conscious experience can be felt. Plants will experience the conscious experience at the levels that they can enter that dance. Animals, amoeba, one-celled animals, the DNA which makes us up can experience the dance at the level that they can respond to it, and we can integrate all of that and respond to it in a much greater way. And I think this is an ongoing thing.
There was an experiment done several years ago by an individual who had hooked up some kind of electrical apparatus to a plant. Now, he had two plants in a relatively dark room, and they were in their little pots. And he walked in there and tore the heck out of one of the plants. He pulled it out of the pot, tore it up, ripped it up, stomped on it, and then walked out. And then they hooked up the electrodes to the other plant. And he came back into the room, this person, and the electrodes must have done something, but that plant hit the meter, and I mean, it was all over the place, Fred. It was as if this plant knew that this person had killed this other plant. And that's incredible.
I've heard of this experiment. I had met the person, I believe, who initiated that kind of experimentation in San Diego. This was 20 years ago, I think. I think his name was Cleve Baxter, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some of our listeners may recall that. And I remember him reporting on this. It was very astonishing at the time. But if you think about it, from the point of view I'm taking, it really isn't so surprising if you realize that that everything is conscious.
And connected.
Yes, connected because we're all part of this one mind of consciousness. We're not individual consciousnesses. Consciousness is not something which can be multiplied. It's always of one. And we experience it separately as individuals, but we're still of that one mind, which is also on the plants and the animals too. So that's why in certain cultures, because you recognize that you're all one, you take it, this goes back to your questions at the beginning of the evening, actually, you take it as part of ritual to recognize that, and that's what makes it spiritual, so that you understand sacrifice, and you understand that when you eat a plant, there is a great sacrifice. We now have prayers. We pray at our meal or something, which is indicating our awareness of the sacrifice that has been given, that gives us sustenance by the food we eat from the plants or the animals that we eat. It's the same basic thing. And so it's very important to keep that sacred flame of awareness alive, because it reunites you, it reconnects you, it lets you experience the awe and wonder in the universe rather than just seeing it as a dead place.
Take, for example, the books you've written, Taking the Quantum Leap, Parallel Universes, The Dreaming Universe, and you've got several more, and they're all wonderful books. Now, magnify what you know, Fred, today by 100 years, and if you had to write those books again 100 years from now, how much more knowledge would you have, the Fred Allen Wolf, who's 100 years older than he is today, writing these books, how much more knowledge do you think you might have, and how much would change in terms of that knowledge with what you've written about today?
Here's what would happen. If I'm on the right track now, and I believe I am, then we're going to see a gradual recognition of the spiritual component of all science. Something which seems almost anathema to what scientists today will seem of natural course 100 years from now. So that when I'm reborn again as a kid growing up, I will be growing up in an era where the awe and wonder of spirit and science together will be part and parcel of my teaching, so that I won't have to learn it as I had to learn it, which is to fight my way through all the mechanics of the world who kept telling me God is dead and the universe is dead and this is all dead stuff. I'll be coming into God is alive, the universe is alive, we're in a living spiritual universe. That'll be my natural place. So there'll be a natural amount of creativity that'll be flowing. It won't just be me, it'll be all of us. And that's what I'm looking forward to. I'm not just looking to how I might get better. What I'm really looking to is the way we as a human kind, we as a being, can become being of light, that we can become more enlightened, that we can begin to live in a way in which there's a lot more humor in the world, there's a lot more love in the world. And I don't mean the kind of crazy sex advertisement game that we're playing in the world today, but a genuine feeling of love in which sex is understood. And by the way, I have a whole different approach to what sex is really all about. It has really to do with tuning to the future. And so there'll be a number of things that will be very, very different, that will make life, I think, a lot easier and a lot more fun and alive for people.
Well, what will catch up? Will science catch up with consciousness? Consciousness to science, or will they kind of like march to the same tune?
They're going to blend. There's going to be a great blending. Probably the first major revolutions will start to occur in biology. Physics kind of come to the end of the tether, so to speak. There's really physicists are really kind of stuck in the old particle mold. They're trying to find instead of little tiny specks called particles, they're now looking for little tiny things called strings. But we've not really been able to get very far with that problem. It still introduces as many problems as it pretends to solve. So physics is coming to an end, but biology is just emerging. We're now coming into all kinds of questions, and the biological questions don't just get into mechanism, they get into, should we do this? Do we clone? What is a cell? The questions of life and death are becoming more magnified by our increased knowledge of biology. So I think biology is going to be in this century, in this next 100 years, the field which will blend the spiritual, the mystical, and the scientific. Also, psychological studies will come into it, because as we get into more neurobiology, we'll be understanding possibly the neurobiology of the spiritual experience. So they're going to blend. It's not that one's going to be the explanation of the other. That would be a mistake. What will happen is there'll be a kind of a blend. There'll be a recognition of something that can't be explained by the old way, which is that everything is made from dead matter pounding together.
They're beginning to find a planet. They found about 100 planets now circling other suns out there in our galaxy. What is it about this order that appears to make everything uniform, Fred? And by that I mean now we're believing that there are planets out there, and depending on how close they are to their own respective sun, that might determine whether there's life there, whether it's intelligent or otherwise. But why is it all the same? How come there's nothing dramatically different here?
Interesting question, George. Think of it this way. The kinds of things that you can see are only those things that you can bring up to your mind and your consciousness.
All right.
So if you believe and can only see planets, then you're going to be looking out there for things and experiences that you can call planets. If you see and you believe in things called stars and suns and galaxies, then you're going to be looking out there for things called stars and suns and galaxies. In other words, whatever you believe is there, you're going to be looking for it. Now, what's happened in the present situation in cosmology is that we've looked so hard and we found so many problems that at the present moment, I think the current understanding is that approximately 99% of the mass and energy of the universe just ain't there. It's in a form of dark, exotic ooga-booga. Nobody knows what it is.
You're right, exactly.
And because what we're doing is just saying, oh, well, let's look out there. That's matter, that's energy, that's this, that's all the things we understand, all the things we understand. But, you know, if that's the way it is and that's what makes the universe work, then it doesn't work because 99% is missing. We don't understand this. We have to invent a new terminology, dark matter, magic matter. It becomes, you know, just the game of trying to salvage the old way of thinking. We've gone through scientific revolutions in which somebody eventually sees, like in the story of the Emperor's New Clothes, that the Emperor is walking around stark raving naked. And we'll eventually see that our present understanding of the whole Big Bang cosmology model is kind of like an emperor's is like a naked emperor wearing the clothes that we pretended that this emperor is wearing. In other words, that isn't the correct theory. There may be something that my hint as to what's going to go on is to recognize that when we're looking at events that are so far away as to go back to the time of 200,000 years after the Big Bang, we're looking at quantum events. We're looking at things like that. We're not looking at swarms of data. We're looking at little tiny bits and pieces, and we're putting that together. In other words, looking back in time to the beginning of the universe is like looking at subatomic matter and trying to piece together what it looks like. And we guessed that subatomic matter was little tiny billiard balls bouncing around down there, and we were wrong. Quantum mechanics told us, hey, that isn't the way it's going on there. I think quantum mechanics is also going to, I think, help us understand that maybe we're looking at the edge of what we mean by space, time, and matter, and that we really don't know how big anything is. We're only guessing based upon the nature of our observations and some of the earlier models, like the Hubble Expanding Universe model that came back in the 1920s and 1930s. To make our best guess. But I really think that we ourselves, by the choices we make of how we make our measurements, are actually creating what we see out there. In other words, we're actually seeing things that are our own imagination rather than things that are actually out there. It's kind of like, I remember when a friend of mine once came up to me and he said, look, you know, I think when I look at this photograph, I can see a face, a ghost-like face in this curtain, and I look at the curtain, I don't see it, but this person sees it.
He sees it, that's right. Or he looks at a cloud and sees some image.
Exactly, exactly. And I believe, you know, that what he sees for him is very real. It doesn't mean, because I don't see it, that it's not there. It just means that it's not real for me. In other words, reality isn't always a question of agreement between various observers if that's real. I learned this from Native American teachers, by the way, who taught me that just because you don't see something doesn't mean that the other guy who sees it is having an hallucination. It may be you're having an hallucination by not seeing it.
You ever see the movie Shallow Hal?
Yes, I love that movie.
Well, that's your example right there.
Right, exactly. That was a wonderful movie.
What When I was a boy, Fred, I used to love biology, and I was fascinated with frogs and animals and everything like that. And I began to look at these animals, and I said, you know what? They've got two eyes, they've got a nose, they've got a couple ears, they've got a mouth, and a lion's got one, and a cat has one, and a dog has one, and a frog has one, and a fish has it. But, you know, they all look different, but they all have similar traits as well, including humans. And I couldn't quite figure out at that age of about 10 what was so special about this planet that had this abundance of this kind of life. And I still can't figure it out because I'm beginning to wonder if this planet is so unique because it's unbelievable, or there must be a lot of planets exactly like ours.
Well, our planet may or may not be unique. I don't believe it's so unique. I believe that there are lots of planets like ours, that there's lots of life forms like ours.
And what about different kinds, too?
And there may be, and there probably are, a variety of different kinds. We're going to probably, in the next 100 years, develop new forms of life by bringing together mechanical, machine-like, and biological materials in some new ways, a cybernetic type of thing, like the old TV series, The Million Dollar Man, where we'll be getting into all new ways of looking at how matter, so-called inert matter, and living matter can come to peace together. We're already getting into that.
I'll be replaced by a computer talk show host.
Very possibly.
You know, he'll pick up your words and go, well, what about this, Dr. Wolf? You know?
Yes, well.
And they'll love him.
It's the consciousness in back of it that makes a difference. It's sort of, what I'm sort of saying is that it doesn't make too much difference what the specific life form is actually like when you're looking at it from the point of view of one conscious mind. It makes a huge difference, of course, if you're one phylum or one genus of animal compared to another. It makes a big difference whether you're, you know, one kind of animal to another. Just the other night, I was watching what I never thought I would watch. I was watching a show. It was called about, you know, dogs on show, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was remarkable. I hadn't noticed, it hadn't really dawned on me how many different kinds of dogs there are presently walking our planet. And I was amazed at how magnificent these animals were.
Oh, yeah.
They were just incredible. And what amazed me was their intelligence and their complete conscious behavior with respect to what they were doing. And I thought, my God, this is so incredible. These are wolves. These are dangerous animals that have been cultivated and trained and are far more conscious now as dogs than they were as wolves in a certain sense, more socialized consciousness in a certain kind of sense. That doesn't mean that wolves are not conscious. They are too, but in a different sense. And I can almost see how cultivation has made the dog what it is as compared to the wolf, in the same sense that that we may feel cultivated as compared to, say, ancient spiritual people.
Well, just imagine, stay with us, but imagine, Fred, and I'll talk with you about it after the break. You know, we're about 4.5 billion years old. The universe is about 14 billion years old. Imagine a civilization a billion years ahead of us, assuming they're still around. They didn't blow themselves up or take themselves into extinction. What could that be like? That's incredible. And what we will also do tonight is I'm going to have Dr. Fred Alan Wolf lead us into another consciousness experiment and hopefully try to get some kind of peace out of this whole situation, this madness that could happen. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Email in from Sean in Buffalo. George, I just want to tell you, my mother, father, brother, sister, we all went to my grandmother's birthday party. My grandfather died a few months ago. Before he died, I wrote him a note asking him to let God know that I need him. I was in my kitchen and going to walk upstairs. I saw in the midair an image that looked like a holograph image of space looking at the stars. As I moved closer to this and saw what looked like people walking, massive amounts of people just walking. I moved closer. There were families, and without a doubt, they were all walking together. I actually saw kids, elderly people, walking up to the groups of families. I don't know how I was able to do this, but I did. And then I looked over my shoulder. My grandfather was behind me. I can't believe it. Sean, out there in Buffalo. That's a neat story. Neat story indeed. Let's go to the phones now. Let's go west of the Rockies. You are on Coast to Coast. Thanks for holding. Hi there.
Yeah, hi, George.
Welcome.
Yeah, your boots of arts are getting fuller and fuller every week, it sounds like, from this end of the radio.
We're getting there.
Yeah, you are. It's great. Hey, listen, there's a controversial guest that Art had on back in the mid-90s. He kind of broke open the whole story about contrails. His name is William Thomas.
Is he still alive?
Oh, God, I don't know. I hope so. If he's
actually, I think he is. There was a captain also who was writing about TWA 800. His name was Captain, I believe it was William Donaldson. Huh. I think he may have been the one who passed away.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, William Thomas, Art used to say that when he did a show with about the contrails, he always got a lot of trouble. And, yeah, I know you had Joyce Riley on. She's quite a incredible person. And I think William Thomas is another pretty controversial guy, but I guess he broke open the whole story about contrails. I was wondering what his research has come up with. You know, he started.
I'll tell you, we'll check into that, because we have been talking about doing another major story on contrails and chemtrails, and I assume he's still around, so we will track him down for you. Let's go to our special topic line. You are on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Oh, turn your radio down.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, sir.
Yes, George. I was 18 years old and diagnosed with this eye disease called corneoconus, and they actually operated on the wrong eye. I woke up with bandages on my right eye instead.
Oh, my God. The wrong eye.
Yeah. I had a corneal transplant on the wrong eye.
What did you do? Did you sue them?
Yeah. I mean, later.
How much did you win, if I can ask? And I mean, it doesn't replace the eye, but what were you able to get, can you say?
Well, the thing is that as far as money,
yeah,
I got 300. They settled for 350, but my lawyer got whatever. But I was 18 years old. I was diagnosed because I was going for my driver's test, and you know, I had to do the eye test, and they noticed something wrong. So I went to the eye doctor, and they diagnosed me with this, and went to a specialist. And before I know it, you know, my good eye was taken from me. And I still had the main problem with the other eye.
Oh, my God. Not all the money
surgery,
in the world.
And I decided not to have anybody touch me anymore. So now I got two bad eyes.
How well can you see now?
I'm very, very, well, I had tried to have some, you know, a thing called RK where years ago was done. Now they have lasers, but they can't do anything now. I'm waiting for the technology to get a little better, and hopefully they can help me. But it's been, you know, 15, 18 years now that's just been a mess. Just messed up my life.
And you know, all the money in the world.
Oh, you can't replace.
Not worth it. Can't replace your eyes. No, not at all. That's another one of those unbelievable stories. Unbelievable stories. That special topic line, by the way, is 818-817-0021. They operated on the wrong eye. Wildcard line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes, sir.
This is Todd from Pennsylvania. I'm listening to you. I'm up here in Massachusetts right now. Listening to you on WPRO 680.
Well, welcome to the program, Todd. What's going on?
Hey, I wanted to ask you if you ever heard about the underground Pentagon down in Pennsylvania called Site R?
Yes, I have. As a matter of fact, I was stationed at the Pentagon for 2 weeks for the Navy, but I was never able to get down there to see what was going on.
Yeah, apparently it goes the whole way from Camp David, the whole way up to that mountain, to where the, you know, up in the Blue Ridge Summit. You know, underneath Fort Ritchie and all that, but I've never heard I thought Art used to live down there, and I never heard him mention it.
There are more incredible underground facilities and bunkers for government officials than you can probably imagine, and they're all around the country. But there are some deep ones around the Washington, D.C. area, and that's expected. That's expected. I mean, that's the base of power. And, you know, you got to protect them somehow. You really do. Next up, let's go to first-time caller line. Your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Frank from Mobile, Alabama.
Well, hello, Frank.
And I was listening to Richard C. Hoagland last night,
mm-hmm.
and something astonishing dawned on me. I've been studying the Bible for a number of years, and
mm-hmm.
it is not impossible that there could have been once an extremely highly technological civilization in antediluvial times, before the flood.
That goes back a long, long time, but you know, Richard's thoughts and theories are that something did occur, there was advanced civilization in those days. Tell me why you think so, though.
Well, there are four basic reasons. One, the Bible does not come out and specifically say it's impossible.
Right.
Two, Jesus referred to that when he came back, and the times that he came back would be just like the times in the days of Noah. We see right now we have supercomputers, we have space shuttle technology, we have nuclear technology, we have interplanetary technology. Also, the archaeology points that there have been a few finds that biblical scholars date to around the time of the flood or before the flood, and even a few strange finds that would indicate objects that they don't even know what they are for. They can't even figure out the metallurgy in them.
Well, what happened, though? Why did we lose that technology?
Well, when God destroyed the earth, he also destroyed all of the technology. And he was deliberate about not telling us what existed beforehand. When human beings later tried to build the Tower of Babel,
mm-hmm.
God confused all the languages to set us against each other or be weary of each other, because he knew that if we could unite and get behind each other and get behind science, that we would reinvent the technology that he deliberately destroyed.
Well, and we've done that, but I bet one day some kind of archaeological dig will find something very peculiar. And wouldn't it be just incredible if they find an ancient spaceship down below somewhere in a cavern, just kind of like tucked away, ready to go. All you have to do is flip a switch, and it's on. East of the Rockies, you are on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Mike, first-time caller. I'm a little nervous.
Ah, welcome, Michael. What's going on?
I called over a coincidence. I've been listening to the show for several years now because I was abducted twice, and... Yep, last Wednesday I saw my first UFO hovering over a house.
Now tell me, though, how do you know you were abducted?
Because I was there and I remember it.
You do remember it. How old were you first time?
Oh, about 41.
Ah, all right, so you weren't really young. Tell me what they did to you, Mike.
Oh, the first time they took, well, I was on a spaceship, they took me to their planet, but there was like... seven or eight of us in the spaceship with the Grays. They're different sizes, from small, medium, and large.
Do you remember where the planet was?
No, I don't even know what they called it. They showed it to I don't know why they did this. Well, they showed us their planet, but they mentioned that they showed that how dangerous weapons are because they were... There's different races, and they fight too, like we do down here on Earth. And yes.
Did you walk away thinking that they were good beings?
Good beings? No, they don't care about us. It's all what I understood, what my experience were, and what they did. It was just for themselves. It had nothing to do helping each individual down here. No.
Darn, you know, I would wish that any kind of civilization that might be so advanced to come here would also understand that, you know what, you can't keep fighting. But, hey, according to him, they keep fighting. Let's go to our special topic line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, I got a story. I'm Jason from Santa Cruz, California.
What's your story, Jason?
Well, I had a grandpa, and he went in for an operation, and it was something with the stomach. I don't really know. It was like cancer or something. But so what they did was, anyway, he came out of the operation, and he had some pains, right? And then, and so he goes back because he thought there was something wrong.
Yeah.
Turns out they left a sponge in him, right?
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, so they left a sponge in him, and he goes in for another operation so they can take out the sponge they left in him, and he dies in the operation.
Oh, my.
Because he's too weak to, you know, recover from the second one.
Oh, how pitiful, sad. Oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah, pretty heavy tragedy.
You know, and had they not left the sponge in there, he might have been able to recover from the first operation.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It wasn't like he was a weak person. He was very healthy and fit. And it was just, yeah, it was totally their fault. And we sued them. I don't exactly know for how much, but.
How did you know that there was a sponge in there? I mean, does that show up in the x-rays as some kind of an image? I guess it would, huh?
I'm not really sure how they knew exactly. I was pretty young when the whole thing happened, so I don't really know exactly how they knew that, but. Yeah, I just knew that's what happened.
Man, that's a sad story. Sorry for your loss. I mean, poor grandfather goes into the hospital for a little stomach operation. They leave a sponge in his stomach. See, I knew this was happening. I knew this. Wildcard line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Mr. Norrie.
Yes, sir.
What a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you. You're breaking up a little bit, so let's give it our best shot here.
Three quick things. NASA, chemtrails, and the Kingdom of Nye.
All right, let's go for NASA.
I was stationed at Fort Eustis, Virginia, and I was working on cobras, and we took a tour over to NASA, and we're getting led around by this lady that was a muckety-muck in NASA. And, well, we were looking at a 757 jet, and she was telling us about the high-altitude testing they were doing with it. And I said, you know, I notice the contrails are a little bit different. You know, that used to when I was a kid, they'd just deplete real quick.
Yeah, they dissipated real fast.
Yeah, and I says, now, you know, they'll crisscross and whatever. And I says, pretty soon, you know, I've noticed that it could be a bright, beautiful morning, and the next thing you know, it's just kind of a haze over, you know, real high-altitude haze. And I says, do you know anything about that? And, I mean, we're standing in this jet, and, you know, my knowledge of that isn't really great. I mean, I was only just a crew chief on the Cobras, but I knew it was different, and she just kind of looked at me, and she didn't say a word.
Yeah, she knew.
Well, I just left it at that. And I, you know, at that time, that was 1997, and, you know, the controversy hadn't really gotten totally carried away yet.
Well, it right around that period, all we thought we were seeing were just simply spent jet fuel up there in the atmosphere.
Well, and I heard on your program, I think, a while back that, you know, they did switch to JP-8, and we used to burn JP-4 in the Cobras, and JP-8 is a dirtier fuel. You know, it's less expensive to run.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about that. But I'll tell you, when you look up on a clear night, clear day rather, and it looks like a tic-tac-toe board up there. I mean, within a few hours, it looks like a cloudy night, a cloudy day. It really does. East of the Rockies, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, sir. This is Julian Morris, and I'm in the ministry.
Well, hello, Julian. What's going on with you today?
It is unbelievable. It was a real eye-opening experience. once I had a near-death experience. And I know it's...
When did this happen?
During a heart transplant. I had a heart transplant.
You've got a heart transplant. How long have you had that in you?
8 years. It's going on 8 years.
Good for you. Everything fine? You doing okay?
I would love to say yes, but I've had 21 broken bones.
21 broken bones?
Yes, sir. I have had real adverse side effects from the anti-rejection medicines.
Oh.
I had such a wonderful, God bless me, with such a wonderful immune system that it took nearly 7 years to really knock my immune system down. And this caused, I have two different types of arthritis. And one of them is osteoporosis,
sure,
which is normally confined to women.
Yeah, that's true. They get the humped back there, and
right,
a lot of it caused from lack of calcium on that.
Right. Well, it has dried the bone marrow out in...
How old are you, Julian?
I'm 47.
47, yeah, you're a young guy.
Well, I was in such good shape. That is the main reason that I had the man watching over me, or the, I should say, the my God watching over me.
But with this after death experience that you had, did it leave you feeling not scared about dying?
Yeah, I did not. I wanted to stay where I was. I'm no longer not the least bit afraid of death there. I wanted to stay.
Well, I'm glad you didn't stay. There's no reason to stay, Julian. No reason to stay yet. You keep fighting. Gosh, I wish we could continue with open lines. The lines are jammed. I'm telling you, some of you will want to try again tomorrow. I'll have full open lines all night long. Now, in a moment, my guest will be Fred Wolf, Dr. Fred Wolf. We're going to get into the brain and much more than that. Trust me. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Fred Alan Wolf, my guest. Fred, do you believe in life after death?
Not in the same form that we're experiencing it now, because the life that we experience now is primarily the reflection of the life that comes after death, the one-mind life that I always said I've been talking about quite a bit on the show. With the material body acts as a reflection source of that, and the experience we commonly have is of that reflection. It's kind of like driving down a highway, but steering in the direction you want to go by looking always in the mirror. That's living life in a body.
Right.
When you die, it's like the mirror gets broken, and suddenly, you know, you're looking at things without having the reflection cloud your image of things. Plato talked about this too. I mean, he referred to it as the ideal realm, and that when the ideal moves into the form of the body, it becomes beclouded. It becomes overwhelmed by the senses. And I write about this in a number of my books, particularly The Spiritual Universe, for those out there who want to read more about that.
Well. But,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, you've got me frustrated.
All right, I'm sorry.
No. But the reason for that is there are so many people who have come back testifying, I guess, about after-death experiences, seeing that light at the end of the tunnel, and all those things. And there's got to be something there.
Well, there's a couple things we have to take into consideration. One is that near-death experience is not the same as death. And there, in fact, many people who are skeptical about near-death experience often evoke very materialistic explanations for that. And so they poo-poo it in a certain sense. They say, well, it's really just, this is the way the retina closes down, and this is how the nerve, you know, they go all these into these lengthy materialistic explanations. What I'm saying is that, when you're dying, when death begins to occur, the consciousness, which is normally caught up in the senses, begins to get free of that modality, that way of being. And as a result, certain experiences that you may have been looking for or expect to see begin to occur more often. The light at the end of the tunnel, that may have a physiological explanation, but what you see at the other end of that tunnel may have something to do with what you believe is real. There are reports that people see their relatives, or that they see Jesus, or that they see Moses. There's so many, or Mother Mary.
Mm-hmm,
there are
mm-hmm.
many visuals that people have based upon what their expectation is. I'm not saying that these aren't real. What I am saying is that that's only the tip of the iceberg. That's kind of like when you first come into a house that you haven't been to before, and somebody opens the door and welcomes you in. If the party was only the opening of the door and the welcoming, that might be very warm and very nice, but there's a lot more going on once you get into the party. I think that after you pass through these portals, so, you know, St. Peter's Gate or whatever you want to call it, or go through the tunnel, there's many different opportunities. The Tibetan Book of the Dead talks about this in detail, mainly, of course, for Tibetans, in terms of their culture. There's a fellow whose name was E.J. Gold that wrote a book called The American Book of the Dead. I don't know if he's still around anywhere, but it was remarkable, describing essentially what the Tibetan Book of the Dead did for Tibetans, what would be the American Book of the Dead for Americans, and what they could look forward to.
Well, there's also the Egyptian Book of the Dead.
And there's the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which is really very rich with all kinds of different experiences that the soul must pass through in order to finally enter into the chamber of Osiris and be with Osiris, which is the spirit of regeneration, of life starting all over again. So you know, there are many different ways of talking about it. I'm convinced that life as a living in the bodily form is a reflection of this bigger experience. And it's not the, even though it's important to us as we're living it, and we certainly have get very attached to wanting to live forever even, it nevertheless is a small part of the transformation properties that the ultimate goal of what all this is about, which I again say goes back to, in the beginning was negation, was the saying of no, and that magical negation, that magical blockade, is what brings all of this forth. It brings forth the illusion that I'm not perfect.
What are these aberrations that people see, and these ghostly figures that they see?
There are different ways that can be explained. One way would be that they're actually peering into shadows of alternate reality, of, you know, parallel world realities of some sort, and that they're bleeding through temporarily. I think there may be some possibility to that, that we're actually seeing into all, that there are alternate realities that are just as much around as the one we're in, that can bleed through into this one. There's even some possibility that quantum mechanics may, in the parallel world model, explain some of that, notion of bleeding through. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that we're, momentarily unhinging from time, and that the time lock that we have in the present moment gets momentarily unhinged, and we're peering into the future or the past, maybe at a different location. And we're seeing a glimpse of that. There was some indication of that kind of experience as reported by an English scientist and artist, Paul Devereaux, in one of his books about the appearance of carriages that would appear on a road in northern England, I believe it was, and these carriages were not from the time period of the 80s and the 70s and 80s in which the cars were driven along those roads. They were actually horse-drawn carriages, and there hadn't been horse-drawn carriages on those roads since the 20s when gypsies used to go by horse-drawn carriages on those roads, and people were seeing them at night and things of that sort and reporting them to the local constables.
Sure.
Yeah, right.
You're close.
Close. Constabulary, whatever that. I can't say that word.
Stick to physics, Fred.
Yeah. Exactly, George. So I think those are the two major kinds of possibilities that those things, those bleed-throughs might represent.
You've done a little work into Hopi elders who go out and rain dance sure enough, it rains. I always heard a story in a comical sense that the reason why it always rains is because they don't stop dancing until it rains.
in some ways that's true, but tiring. The reason this works goes back to the ancient roots of magic, out of which science, by the way, first emerges. That is that the recognition that as above, so below, as within, so without. The recognition that there are processes within me that are also occurring out there in nature. So a shaman who is sensitive to this, the one who does the rain dance, will begin maybe to feel maybe an overwhelming sadness or a feeling of great tearing or a feeling of feeling that something impinging, a cloud is going to break, and will then dance in honor of that experience, and then it starts to rain. The notion would be, oh, he caused the rain. The answer that I would give is, no, he wasn't the cause of it. He just acknowledged the presence that he was feeling, and by going out and dancing, he was kind of like a forecaster in a way. He was able to do something the other people weren't able to do because they weren't as sensitively tuned to that as he was. That's what I think is really going on there. I don't think it's not cause and effect like in the Frankenstein monster, I throw this switch and that electrical spark will fly. It's not that. It's more synchronistic. It's more attunement with rather than causing of.
Do you think the mind is so powerful that it could literally move things?
It can, and it does, and it's difficult to do when you are trying to, say, move a large object. It has a lot to do with order and disorder and what is called entropy and the ability to focus. We only have so much general focusing power, intent that we can manifest, and it's very hard to get an object that's like fly off a table or something like that because the amount of energy that's required is not even the energy; it's the ability to focus or organize, kind of like a laser makes light. A laser light can be very powerful, even though the amount of energy in the laser may be very small, but nevertheless, its focusing power is what gives the laser its power. In the same sense, minds tend to not be focused very well, and so it's difficult to get focus. I've seen pictures, and some people may say they're fraudulent, I don't know if they are or not, of a Russian woman who seemed to be moving objects with her mind, and whether that's real or not, I don't know. But psychokinesis, which I think is what the field of that study is called, I believe if done on small enough objects, at least to start with, may turn out to be not fraudulent and may turn out to be a real effect.
I'd like to, for the minutes we have now, we'll take calls next hour, but I'd like you to conduct another one of your consciousness efforts in order to, again, resolve this situation in the Middle East. And let's see what we can do. So how would you like to proceed with that, Fred?
Well, I think the way we would proceed would be to begin by going into a state of quiet, even though I'm going to be speaking, wherever you are at the moment, go into a space of quiet. And if you need to, imagine that you're standing by an ocean and you're watching waves moving and going back and forth. And see yourself as like maybe walking into the water and not drowning, but just walking into the water and floating in the water. So you have this general feeling of floating and being in this great ocean. And gradually let yourself or feel yourself dissolve. You've seen what it looks like to see sugar dissolve in water or salt dissolve in water. Just allow your body to dissolve. And by that I mean you yourself are spreading out throughout that whole ocean so that you're not just confined to one little space. You're now over maybe 6 feet, 10 feet, 100 feet. You're spreading out like just like a wave would be spreading out from a central point. You're dissolving yourself throughout that whole ocean. However, as you grow in size and dissolve out, you're not losing consciousness. You're still this one mind. But as you grow and as you dissolve out, you're beginning to see that you are not different from the ocean itself. That the ocean and you are exactly the same. Now, while you're in that state, imagine a gradual and restful and peaceful vibrational pattern vibrating on the ocean, almost like a wonderful harmonic tone, even maybe symphonic, just like a music, like the ocean is playing music. It's just one great big musical tone. And that your mind is now playing that. And it's a tone of peace and harmony and goodwill and remembrance that you and your neighbor are exactly experiencing the same thing. It's all the same. No difference, no boundaries, no separation. Floating, dissolving, in harmony with. Because that is all you are, nothing separating you. And as you now do that and hold that pattern for a short period of time, maybe as you begin to come back in, you can start seeing yourself focusing, coming together, drawing in, emerging from, and finally coming to a point where you first entered the water. And as you come out of the water and walk to the shore again and stand on the shore and see yourself looking out at the great ocean again, feel inside of you that water, which is the water of your body, for example, and keep the tune of that harmony that you experience in that great ocean within the vibrational pattern of yourself. And wherever you go, just float with that. And as you meet other people who are maybe listening to the show or others, they will resonate with you. They will sense your harmony of peace with you. Be peaceful. Go with that light and peace within you. And I believe, and you will believe, and you will see around you that this harmony is propagating. It's appearing everywhere and will appear in the people you see around you. And will bring the peace that you're looking for to the whole planet.
It truly is a very powerful mechanism, isn't it?
It's very wonderful, and it seems so true. It seems so obvious that when you do it and you practice it and you walk in it, it becomes kind of clear. When you see others who practice it in one form or another and you're with them, it becomes very clear. It's that recognition in the eyes that I talked about that you see in children, for example, that reflects that.
Let me ask you this, though. What if 10 million people have a different cause and they're doing the opposite in terms of what they want from what we want? Who wins?
What you're finding and what you will find that is truth is that there is no opposite cause. All there is fear. There's reluctance to have that experience. And that recoil from this experience is one of fear. And the people that don't have this experience are living in fear. They're just afraid. And your presence is stronger than theirs. You're part of the bigger whole of humanity. It's much, much stronger than the desire to go to war. It's much, much stronger than the desire to hurt or to harm. All those are coming out of fear. They're of the ancient brain. They're the old brain model. One conquers by loving, by letting your own presence be felt rather than trying to change anybody's mind or argue with them. That isn't even necessary. Just be peaceful. Go in peace. And you will affect and you will transform and change, even those who are preparing for going to war.
Will the results be quick?
What's going to happen is going to be very, very rapid, one way or the other, but I really believe we're going to resolve this peacefully. I don't think we're going to be going to war.
And how much of that will be because of so many people who have concentrated on this?
It's going to be because of us. We're what is happening, and we're happening all over the planet. It's not just in the United States. It's not even just Coast to AM listeners. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in Japan. It's happening in Germany. It's happening in Finland. It's happening in Africa. It's happening in South America. It's happening all over.
Okay, stay with us. Dr. Fred Alan Wolf will take phone calls at the top of the hour. Got a question about some of the things we've been talking about, or you've got your own? That's what it's here. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with guest Fred Alan Wolf. Fred, let's talk a little bit before we go to the calls about parallel universes again.
Okay.
Do you believe that there could be thousands of these parallel universes out there?
Maybe an infinite number. It really depends, I believe, on the amount of possibilities that we can conceive of as happening. There's a big, wonderful mystery called quantum physics, which posits the existence of this wave that I've been talking about throughout the whole program. And this wave is infinitely potentially able to be anything. And when we do experiments of any kind, whether it's on an atom or whatever, we find that all of these possibilities emerge as mathematical possibilities. And the number of mathematical possibilities always comes out to be infinite, no matter what we're looking at. I mean, except for some very simple cases, there's always an infinite number of possibilities that show up. So it seems to me that the number of universes that could show up would also be infinite in number.
Now, it's mind-boggling, isn't it?
It's very mind-boggling, and it causes people all kinds of, that can't be right. Everybody has trouble with infinity. The thing which strikes me, though, is if it were finite, well, then, you know, you'd always ask, well, what happens if you get to the end of it? What's the next, what happens if you go one more than
that? Yeah, exactly. And then one more, and then one more.
Exactly. So it seems infinity is actually more natural.
But you know the old saying, you give them an inch, they take a mile.
Exactly. In this case, you take the whole universe.
Well, I agree with you that there could be an infinite amount of universes out there.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar, I think, to this. I don't think we'd find it unusual. With science, it is true that most of the elements on this planet, one would find on other planets as well, right?
Most likely. The thing is that what happens in these universes is that if you were to somehow peer at them all as if they were like cards in a deck of cards, okay, or film little squares of film on a film strip, and you were to look at them all at once from a different perspective, being at a distance above them, you would see that most of them would look exactly alike. But as you got towards the fringes of the film strip, you begin to see more and more differences showing up. So there would be pockets where there's a lot of similarity, and then differences showing up, and then pockets again of a lot of similarity, and then maybe some more differences showing up. In other words, there would be very few of them would be really maverick universes. Most of them would be very much like our universe, but with slight differences. For example, in another universe, George Norrie would be at home, sitting in a chair, talking to Fred Wolf, who's running the show Coast to Coast, AM, but not in America, but, on a Martian colony, or something like that.
All very possible.
Right.
Let's go to some calls. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Howdy, George.
Hi.
One of the things that, two things interested me, mostly that since I have practiced hypnosis, it sounded like the good doctor was invoking the methodology of hypnosis to reassure the audience and make them feel good. Possibly he was aware of doing that, and possibly he was not, because I believe that what's coming up in this particular program, even though the good doctor is a physicist, is that aspiration, superstition, and all the other manifestations of mankind, including all the books of the dead, are entering into the realm of science where they really don't have a place, therefore physics takes kind of a back seat. I think methodology in physics, where modeling is used not to produce an infinite number of models, which are pointless, but to produce models which are potentially working models where experimentation can either prove or disprove those models. And unless science sticks to their guns, scientists stick to their guns and does that or do that, then they're exercising the futility that mankind has done ever since we can remember his doing anything. By the way, I also believe that the footprint that somebody mentioned in the rock may very well be a civilization that I believe that entropy is one of the chief factors in all organizations all the time and forever will be. I'm thinking of Lancelot Lowell White and his next development in man, where he talked about process theory, where you're always going to have two valued orientations, clusters of potential outcomes, always two values and many, many sets of these values in each process that we observe. And if that's the case, we all our aspirations will come to experiments where we continuously always deal with up, down, left, right, small, large. There's a large difference between dualism and duality. But the universe is, and we have to face it, duality, and so are we in it. And any attempt to reach God and make God into something is antithetical to what the possible abstract meaning of God is.
All right, let's get the take from Fred Allen Wolf.
Right.
And the caller sounds like he himself could be a physicist almost.
The caller is obviously a very intelligent fellow and seems to have a tremendous background in a lot of different subjects. I really don't know where to begin here.
Well, did you hypnotize us, first of all?
by this? Is there something specific that we can look at in a short time rather than trying to answer everything that the caller brought up, because there's a lot of subject matter.
Let's talk a little bit about whether you hypnotized us or not, did you?
I am not a hypnotist, and while the listener may have, in his understanding of hypnosis, saw this as hypnosis, and in his understanding of the nature of psychology, saw this as maybe creating some feeling of good in people, my intent was to use a metaphor of the quantum wave of possibility, and my imagination took me into what I remember experiencing of this metaphor as a child going into the ocean and that feeling. So while it may have ended up in the listener's mind as a hypnotic trance or a meditation state of hypnotism or a state of feeling good, for me it was an opportunity to share with you my imagination of how I envision the one mind, so that listeners out there who don't know quantum physics or don't know hypnosis for that matter, could share in that experience by simply imagining it. I appreciate the listener's point of view, but that wasn't necessarily my intent. If it did produce a feeling of good and a feeling of warmth or a feeling of relaxation, well, that's good too. It was intended to do that as well.
What was your key point in your book, Taking the Quantum Leap?
To teach people the remarkable way that the universe operates according to the principles of quantum physics. And at the same time, I wanted to show the history of the idea, that the idea really began in the time of the early Greeks, probably starting with the thinking of Zeno and his paradoxes. And I wanted to show that as the idea became clear to us, that matter wasn't fixed and just out there, but was dependent on the kinds of observations we made of it, and that it could change as a result of that, that the physicists themselves that had made these discoveries were themselves undergoing what might be called a traumatic reaction to them, almost in disbelief. And I illustrated in the book how each scientist, as they came up with the discovery, like 5 or 6 years later, were almost apologizing for the discovery, saying, if I would have known that it would have done this, I never would have invented it in the first place. So there was a remarkable thing that the worldview of mechanism is a worldview of objectivity. It's a worldview in which the effects of human beings upon that worldview is either mechanically determined or Darwinianly determined or fixed in the past determined, and therefore there's no free will in a certain sense. Or the material world is following the laws of mechanical reality. There's really nothing we can do about it. The quantum picture changed all that. It said, no, it doesn't quite work that way. The observations, the mind of the experimenter enters into that reality, and even the very things we're talking about, the pictures we have in our mind of what things are out there, at particularly the atomic and subatomic level, really depend on our pictures. They're not actual descriptions of what's really there. We don't really know what's really there. All we can do is talk about our descriptions and write models of those descriptions, and to the extent that they represent or appear like experimental data, we say we have an understanding. In the old days, it was F equal MA, an object falls, there's a law, there's a differential equation, there's a mathematical thing which tells me when and so forth. Quantum mechanics doesn't deal with F equal MA. It says there's a probability pattern, there's a wave, and that pattern changes according to law. But what actually is happening in the material world is pop, pop, poppity, pop, 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 almost random, but yet following a pattern.
Very good. Let's go to our wildcard line. You're on Coast to Coast with Dr. Fred Allen Wolf. Hi there.
How are you doing, George?
Good.
This is Mike from Fontana, California. Listening to you on AM 640 KFI.
KFI, the monster of Los Angeles.
Yes. How are you doing, Dr. Wolf?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah. My point of view was coming up here. I've always been a kind of a spiritual man. I've believed in afterlife all my life. I grew up as a Christian, of course, but I guess the thing about it is, I have different ways of looking at forms of afterlife. I think of different forms of afterlife as spiritual, but I also think that there is a physical physicality in that, meaning that there's some. I think of physical form as you and me, not per se in heaven, but in some third dimensional realm. I've always been intrigued because I've studied up on it, and I've always been intrigued by that. And I'd like to get your take on different forms that we take after we die. I've been that kind of person. I've been, you know, I'm a very spiritual person, but I also believe in different forms of afterlife.
Okay. First, I just want to let you know that I'm going to be signing books at the Bodhi Bookstore on the February the 22nd in Los Angeles in West Hollywood. If you're in the neighborhood, come in and buy a book at the Bodhi Tree.
It's a week ago, week away.
Yes, that's right, a week away. Let me now go to your question. When you, from my understanding of this, and from the dream experiences that I've had of this realm, when you first go into the realm, what you're saying is true. You carry with you the representations of the world that you had while you were in the living body form. But as you spend time there, and time, it doesn't necessarily mean linear time like we think of it. It may be a kind of a circular time. I'm not even sure how time works in this realm, but I don't think it works like it works in our realm. At least it doesn't work as we imagine it in that realm. But we can imagine some kind of progression. And as that progression goes on, there is a kind of a dissolution, almost in the same way that I was describing what happens when you go into the ocean and dissolve into it. There's a kind of dissolving. And eventually you dissolve so much that there is no more investiture, that is an investment, a hard currency, material investment in holding on to the very patterns that you did inculcate and bring forward in the life that you led previous to that point. After a certain progression, that becomes a kind of a dream, that life that you had before. And you begin to see the other possibilities. You also begin to see that how what was accumulated in that life is also what was accumulated in the lives of lots of people, that you weren't the only one going through this life feeling that, having that experience, worrying about those things, not doing this, and that there are a number of mindsets more or less like yours, and you begin to kind of pool together. And there's a kind of a patterning which gets formed there. And that patterning then leads into a reincarnation, a coming back in. It's kind of at your choice, depending on how well you can identify with this consciousness. It's kind of at your choice as to how you're going to come back in. If you get frightened by it, and a lot of people do, apparently, if you get frightened by it, you just fall into it, and you kind of blindly go. But either through meditation or practices that the Dalai Lama talks about, there are ways in which you can practice this art of dying so that you can reassure that when you incarnate again, that the experience you're going to have at this point will be, quote-unquote, better, richer, or more spiritual, more intelligent, whatever you wish it to be at that point. I'm kind of guessing on the last bit of what I just said, but I think the first parts, I think, are fairly accurate.
Fred, are we living an illusion?
In the sense that only believing that material reality is real and everything else is not, that is the major illusion. There is a reality here, but it's not what it appears to be. What it appears to be is the illusion. There is hardness, there is three dimensions, there is space, there is time, but these are all also so much made by mind that one gets habitualized to the point that one no longer sees one's own doing and making it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to the point of feeling either victimized by it or hopeless by it or hopeful or some kind of sense of identity separate from it. And you do what you call the best as you can. But you feel almost a sense of powerlessness from it. It's kind of like when you first start riding a bicycle, you can see how all the possibilities that can happen, falling over to going fast to going slow to whatever. Once you get in the habit of doing it, you can't imagine that you're doing it anymore. It's kind of you're not even conscious that you're pedaling.
You almost don't know how to fall anymore.
That's it exactly. You don't know how to get off of it anymore. And I believe that a lot of what we call life is so habitualized that we forgot the magic that we all have. I know from my own experiences dealing with shamans in particular that altered conscious states, which are brought on by ceremony, fasting, or the use of psychotropic plants, alter the mindset so that you can perceive this other way of seeing.
My guest is Dr. Fred Alan Wolf. We're going to continue to take your phone calls, your questions for him as we talk about consciousness and universal things on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment. Don't go away. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Fred Alan. Well, Fred, if you could get one thing answered of universal questions that you might have in your mind, just one thing, what would that be?
I would say to God, how do you do this trick? I want to see the secret. I want to get behind it. I want to know, why is there something rather than nothing? How do you do it?
What if he says, Fred, it's not a trick?
That'll even be more amazing.
Yeah, then what do you do? Let's go to the phones. Let's go west of the Rockies. You are on Coast to Coast with Dr. Wolf. Hi there.
George, Fred, good evening.
Yes, sir.
Hi, this is Justin in Huntington Beach.
Hi, Justin.
That was really funny, that last little remark right there. I got a quick comment and a question kind of tied in with it.
All right.
My comment is, I definitely don't really have a versed understanding of the technical aspect of much of what you're talking about, but I kind of feel, and I believe that everyone kind of deep down feels that they have an understanding of all of this that maybe they don't choose to listen to. But I kind of think that my comment is, if you could step back from the universe as we see it and look at it from outside and just see all these little galaxies just sitting there in space and just speed it up really, really, really fast, so everything is spinning around at light speed, what you would see would kind of look like an atom. And on the other side of the coin, if you zoomed in on an atom to the very, very small and looked at that with everything spinning around super fast and you slowed it down, that basically you'd be seeing what would look like the universe.
Do you follow him there, Fred?
Yeah, I do. Interesting picture analogy. It's one that has occurred before. In fact, it was the driving picture that Niels Bohr was working on when he came up with his planetary model of the atom. You've got to imagine, I mean, this is very interesting, and caller, thanks for bringing this to our attention, that during the times that people were inventing or coming up with what an atom looked like, they had no idea. They didn't know whether it looked like a sponge rubber cake with electron raisins embedded in it, you know, like a big doughy ball, a tiny little doughy ball, or what were the electrons doing inside of the atom? And Bohr said, well, they're like planets going about the sun, and that most of the mass of the planet is in the mass of the central core of the atom, the so-called nucleus of the atom. And that was the planetary model, the solar model of the atom. However, quantum mechanics began to alter our perception of that, and what it began to look like wasn't more like little raisins whirling about some central core. It began to look like some kind of symphony orchestra in which all you could see were the moving vibrational patterns. And when you tried to make an observation or to look at the light that came off of that atom or do something like that, suddenly the orchestra would stop playing and it would throw a spitball at you as the electron came flying out of the atom. Or else it would send off a flash of light and the orchestra would then start playing a different tune. It was more like that. It was very bizarre. It didn't fit the old planetary model. Now, it may be that if we speeded up the galaxy and the galaxy of galaxies, the whole globular, clustular material and the superclusters and all of those, that if we looked at them very rapidly, that they may indeed look like some kind of a great wave or orchestral wave of vibrational patterns. I wouldn't be surprised. It's an interesting idea.
You know, NASA's saying that there are about 400 more asteroids out there that could be on impact courses with the planet.
Have you noticed lately how many warnings we've been getting about?
I'm getting tired of this stuff.
every 5 minutes, where this guy's going to attack us, that guy's going to attack us. I mean, it's
asteroids are going to get you, tsunamis are going to get us, volcanoes are going to get us. But you know what? We're still here. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, this is Dr. Daniel in Omaha.
Hello, Dr. Daniel.
Dr. Daniel.
Yes, I'm really enjoying Fred here because it's like listening to myself.
Where are you going, Dan?
Yeah. Well, your level of awareness is right there with my own, and it's really, really intriguing.
Well, parallel universes, Fred, you and Dr. Dan.
Well, I'm honored to be at his level.
Yeah. Well, the vibration is there. Anyway. My PhD is in... more of the chaos theory and optics.
Wonderful. Great.
Yeah, you've got relativity, quantum physics, and then we call it chaos theory as the third one because it kind of changed all of Newtonian physics in the last 10, 20 years.
Oh, it sure has.
Anyway, the question I was going to ask you is that you've been talking about all of these things. Have you been able to use it to demonstrate anything like time travel or moving things around? Or,
good question.
On your own, what I'm talking about.
I actually have been able to not demonstrate. I have not been thinking about the time travel problem as much. I've been really very interested right now in psychology and something I call new alchemy. That's what I've been writing about. And what I've gotten interested in is not how we time travel, but how is it that this one mind forms these individual things we call selves, running around with little egoic concerns that they are what they think they are, little bodies running around. What is the process by which that happens? How does consciousness form into seemingly separate little bodies called selves? And I'm working on, I think, a rather remarkable model, which now seems to be attracting the attention of managers of business. Me why, but they suddenly see that there may be some way to do business in a different way using some of the models that I'm coming up with based
upon
these quantum physical ideas. Because, you know, the egoic self doesn't necessarily have to be a bodily self. It could be a corporate self, or it could be a team self. And if there's a way of understanding how that self-concept arises, we may be able to see what's causing the self-vision that arises when, say, a country goes to war or thinks it's going to go to war.
Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast. You're on the air with Dr. Fred Allen Wolf.
Hi there. Hi, are you, George? This is Cecilia calling from Las Vegas.
Well, hello, Cecilia.
Hi. Before I get to ask your guest a question, I want to let you know how much I enjoyed that magazine, The Exquisite Beauty. It's wonderful.
After Dark?
Yes,
yeah.
I love
great.
It. It's a
thank
wonderful
you.
Magazine. It's beautiful. But I'd like to ask Dr. Wolf if he has an scientific explanation for those of us who have experienced the shaking bed syndrome.
Ah, the shaking bed syndrome, Dr. Wolf. Huh? And a lot of people feel this, huh?
I have to tell you something. I live in San Francisco, so I can tell you that I have shaking bed syndrome quite often.
All right, you're taking the scientific.
Here, so
you're taking
real. Yeah. But I don't know if I really understand exactly what this
let me explain. This is where somebody is in bed, sometimes in a paralyzed state, sometimes not. But the bed literally shakes as if there's some kind of an entity shaking it, rumbling it. Now, of course, you've come up with a possible reasonable explanation, and that could be a tremor somewhere. That you can't rule out. But what about things that are happening that may be subconsciously related?
Well, there are some possibilities. First, let me get to the most mundane. One is your body is making the bed shake. Why? How? Well, you're not aware of it. But when you're in paralytic sleep, there can be muscle twitches that you're not consciously aware of
in
your body, which when you shift the body in your bed, particularly if it's a four-post bed or, you know, four-leg bed, that isn't quite – four legs aren't stable, by the way. Three will form a stable pod, but four, you know, one can wobble a little bit. So if you shake on that bed in some way or move in some way, it could cause the bed to shake, and you may then feel the reverberations of that.
So are you telling me to shave the fourth leg off my bed?
Yeah, right. Three-legged bed.
Exactly.
That's one possibility. Another possibility is you're in a dream state. By the way, I've had this experience. Now that the listener has clued me in as to what she was talking about what this experience is, I've had this experience. I lived in Paris for a number of years. I was teaching at the University of Paris, as you know from my record.
Yes.
And while I was there, for some reason, I can't even explain this, I took a room. Not knowing where I was going to be living, I took a small room, like almost like a cell, on the fifth floor of a walk-up apartment building, and I was later on told that I was living across the street from the Marquis de Sade. And I deliberately moved there. I don't know why. But while I lived there in this kind of attic cell, okay, I would have these griffin-like animals fly into my room and land on my bed and shake my bed with me in it. It happened one night after another. It was like the Notre Dame griffins, you know,
yeah.
would fly into my room. Well, Paris will do that to you. It's a wonderful city for if you want to explore ancient things like that.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
See, it does happen. First time caller, you're on the air on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
My name's Jim. I'm calling from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Hello, Jim. What's on your mind tonight?
Something quick. I noticed last evening's program about NASA and tonight with time travel and,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. There's a novel that I had read. Actually, it's a series of novels by a fellow, if I remember correctly, his last name is Hogan, which had me a little floored last evening. But anyway, it talks about the last novel called Introverse, I think is something about a universe within a universe or something like that. And it sounds kind of like what your guest is talking about this evening, but I was really taken aside by the thing with the moon and all the planet exploding and things like that. It just sounded to me like it would make a really great movie. Plus, you know, it it sounded like he read the book. What do you think about, because it mentioned something about toroids in that book, something that creates a real high density or something like that for time travel.
And what,
like
what were they called, toroids?
I think it was spelled T-O-R-O-I-D-S. Toroids. I'm not sure if that's correct or not. Like I said, it's been a while since I read the book, but it had something to do with really dense gravity pull and creating black holes, basically, essentially creating time travel.
Well, on a scientific end, without knowing exactly what these toroids might be, Fred.
I can offer some explanation.
Sure.
Here because
sure.
I happen to know a little bit about this. Here's the story. The nucleus of every atom is very densely packed with matter. If you were to take two atoms and put them together, the electronic quantum cloud keeps the nuclei from getting very close together. That's why it's very hard to have controlled thermonuclear fusion or any kind of fusion experiment. It's very difficult to do. But if you could somehow strip away all the electrons and strip away the positive charges of the nuclei, and you could squeeze those two nuclei together, and if you were to squeeze a teaspoonful of nuclei together like that and form one teaspoonful of nuclei, it would weigh something like 10 billion tons or something like that. It would be hugely dense.
Huge.
Right. Well, imagine a neutron star. A neutron star has as much mass as an ordinary star, but it's only about 15 or 30 miles in diameter. And it's made of pure nuclear matter, densely packed together like that. Okay? Now imagine you have about 100 of those neutron stars, and you squeeze them together. You kind of, just pretend they're like soft putty, and you stick one onto the next one, and then one onto the next one, and you form a cylinder. Okay, we can imagine bending that cylinder around into the form of a donut. You follow me?
I'm with you.
And now that donut would be a nuclear donut, very dense, with a hole in the middle. And now you set the whole thing rotating, so it's rotating outside in. You follow what I'm saying? It's spinning. It's rotating in. Then you would create in the concentric donut surrounding the nuclear donut, which you know it's like a field. Just imagine you were to put your finger and thumb around this donut with your finger and thumb in the hole, and your fingers would be around the donut. Imagine a whole hand going around it that way. That whole field around that donut would contain in it zones of time reversal and zones where time machines could operate. And I think maybe that's what the listener is referring to.
All right, let's squeeze in another call or two. You are on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
And this is George.
This
Freeway
is
California.
Oh,
KMJ,
you're George, too. Two of us, huh?
50 kilowatts.
Well, hi, George. Go ahead.
Yeah, the nickname is Freeway.
Hi, Freeway.
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 Because the real name is Lane. I got you. George?
Yes, sir.
You're one of a kind. Thank you so much for coming in with.
That's my pleasure. For
you betcha. You know, I. Well, that happened to me as an accident. I can't help it. It just somebody ran that across me and just flipped me out. When
right.
It comes to ham radio, I'm a W6. By all means, George, go for it.
I am good.
All I have to say is I know Dr. Wolf will understand this. Back in the 50s, there was a glut. Just an absolute glut of surplus equipment. And I would donate blood up at the Oakland to go to the airport in order to buy some garbage. Well, it wasn't garbage. It was pristine. It was brand new. And I've had my hands-on experience all my life with all kinds of stuff like that. I'm still doing it, and I can't get it out of my system. But to make it brief, Dr. Wolf, can you respond further? I think you just kind of got off on a tangent when the question of a re-life or a reincarnation type of re-life, in as much as there have been so many studies where young children can remember the road, the street, the address, and all these other really strange things, and I tie that into when I was before 1 year of age, I can remember that. I can remember lifting my foot up and studying this weird thing, and I was wondering, how in the world, what does that do, you know? And it's such a strange thing that with exposure to the life process, it's like you're not a clear slate. You're just very responsive to certain things. And if the right information comes in, boom, you know, wow, you're really tuned into that and very excited about it. And well, I would like your response to the idea of life, afterlife, in the body or otherwise, again, in that way. And I highly recommend the study of Gurdjieff, The Master Game by Dr. D. Ropp, as a book to read. If you could get somebody in there who was a skilled Gurdjieffian master, it would be wonderful fun.
All right, I'll look into that. And we've got about 35, 40 seconds to go, Fred. I don't know if you can give him a complete answer, but why don't you wrap things up for us here?
Think of it this way. Your spirit, the one spirit, has tuned into a body which has a certain amount of genetic and cellular structural material, which is still reverberating and broadcasting the static of its own molecular forms as they're beginning to come together. Each little atom, molecule, nerve cell, blah 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 blah, da 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 da. Now you come in with the spiritual self, the soul, which is incarnated into this thing, and you begin to integrate all that stuff together into one form, one kind of experience. Every once in a while you hit on a station.
We gotta do this again, Fred. You got it. Let's do this again, huh?
Sure will.
That's Dr. Fred Alan Wolf. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Benjamin Pratt, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, webmaster.